And let us turn for our preaching text today then to Romans 13, 1-7, part 2 of our message, Resistance. Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Would you have no fear of the one who is in authority? Then do what is good, and you will receive his approval, for he is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain. For he is the servant of God, an avenger who carries out God's wrath on the wrongdoer. Therefore, one must be in subjection, not only to avoid God's wrath, but also for the sake of conscience. For the same reason, you also pay taxes. The authorities are ministers of God attending to this very thing. Pay to all what is owed them. Taxes to whom taxes are owed, revenue to whom revenue is owed, respect to whom respect is owed, honor to whom honor is owed. In my prayer journal this week, I came across a couple that I hadn't prayed for in quite a while. I have a prayer journal where I have every person I know in this journal. And you're all in there. And you're all numbered, too, which are more than a number. Very early in my pastorate, I counseled this couple. They had an intractable situation. Both of them espoused the biblical model of marriage, the one flesh union between one man and one woman, a covenant bond for life, and she faithful to him, he faithful to her. In fact, he was a candidate for office at the church at the time. Yet his behavior began to belie his profession. He traveled a good deal in his job and regularly cheated on his wife. She was faithful to him, submitting to his leadership, serving him only. She kept the home, birthed and raised the children, aspired to be the heart of hearts for her husband. But he, on the other hand, lived a life of hypocrisy. He taught courses on marriage for Sunday school in the church, but he lived a life that transgressed all of the covenant stipulations that make it sacred. He trumpeted loudly how a wife must be submissive and obedient to the husband, and he saw to it that she fulfilled this to the letter, and how the husband must be loving and faithful to the wife, but regularly cheated on her, treated her with neglect at best. He held up the role of the father as a model for the children to follow, but provided rather an example of unfaithful worldling to his own kids. None of his kids subsequently followed Christ either. What was she to do? She was faithful to the terms of the covenant, doing all that was required. He, on the other hand, was faithful with his mouth, but traitorous with his heart and behavior. In fact, he was not even pretending after a while. They are divorced. He even confessed to me that he is not willing to alter his behavior either, even though his best efforts to hide his hypocritical life had failed. In the end, she divorced him. It wasn't pretty, nor was it peaceful. He threw fits. He accused her of being unbiblical for divorcing him. To his mind, she was betraying him for refusing to stay and make the marriage work. Yet the irony was that he was the one persistently betraying the marriage bond, breaking its stipulations, guaranteeing that the marriage would never work. Indeed, to an outsider, he might have had a case if only the outward facts were considered, but the broken covenant lay at his feet, not hers. The question that we have before us today on this 4th of July Independence Day weekend, 2014, is analogous in part two here, resistance. When is it legitimate to divorce the government that has repeatedly, intentionally, with great malice, broken covenant with its people? Unlike some of the preachers and thinkers that we reviewed last week, our founders did wrestle with this question. They did not come to revolution and resistance lightly. They took this text very seriously and expounded it very well. But what is the solution when we follow all of the commands of this text, even as our founders were loyal and faithful to the king? You heard my citation of the extreme reticence that our founders had in having to do this, right? We follow the commands of this text, acknowledge that government is God-ordained. We looked at this last week. Government is indeed God-ordained. That it is there to reward the righteous and punish the wicked, and has a legitimate claim to tax revenue, too, and legitimate claim to respect. How do we do this when at the same time government, for its part, blasphemes and denies that God, rewards wickedness and punishes righteousness, and then evidences itself to be thieves of the public treasury and dishonorable rather than honorable? As we observed last week, our Anabaptist brothers, and I cited in particular John MacArthur, make this text absolute over all others, don't they? I love John MacArthur. He's benefited me greatly, his ministry in the past, his books. He loves the text. He's very careful with the text and exegetes it with great conscience and skill, too, for that matter. And he holds, of course, that submission to government as a general principle in this, resistance is never legitimate. Submission to government as a general principle is equated with obedience to all governments at all times in every instance. MacArthur declares this in his introduction to his sermon on our same text. It's on YouTube, and I would encourage you to go ahead and screen that, because he does an excellent job of putting forth the Anabaptist position that indeed resistance to tyrants is never biblical. And he holds this text as stretches the text to indeed be applicable in all cases and in every instance. However brutal or unjust or idolatrous the government may be, it must be obeyed unquestioningly by the Christian. And he tries to buttress this assertion by mischaracterizing the nature of the Roman Empire, for example, during the period in which Paul composed this text. And ergo, if it was so for Paul, it should be so for us. Read a history book, please, before you make this critique. For example, MacArthur paints the Roman Empire as rapaciously greedy in taxing its subjects, for which there were many tax revolts in its day. Yet a recent study by Scheidel and Friesen, which one professor called a careful paper, Scheidel and Friesen note that during the period encompassed here, the Roman Empire, and I quote from the study now, did not capture more than 5 to 7% of GDP, and the Roman taxes were fairly low, unquote. On the other hand, Liberty for Life Association calculates that real tax rates on wages alone in the United States of America amount today to 37% of GDP. And those of you who check your pay stubs each week know this, don't you? Actual taxes, that is, hidden taxes, included here, that includes local property taxes, gas taxes, road taxes, telephone taxes, they goes on and on, now medical taxes, right? Actual taxes increased that capture to 52% of income in America. That's 10 times, right? If depending on your figures, 10 times Peter will give us the exact figure, almost 10 times as much as the Romans pay, we are paying. As of today, our federal government owes an apology to the emperors of Rome for far exceeding their tyranny. So MacArthur's just wrong on this. MacArthur also notes that slavery existed in Rome at the time. Ergo, if they had slavery in there, then we're supposed to obey them, then we need to obey our government too. Well, in this, he attempts to cast guilt by association. The system of servitude in Rome is complex and nuanced, isn't it? Some of you have done some research on this. I've talked with some of you on this subject. The system of servitude by equation, right, one with another, he tries to say it's the same as abject racial slavery practiced in America before the Civil War. Not so. Servants and slaves in the Roman Empire ranged in a spectrum of brutal slavery, granted, like that of Israel in Egypt, or captives in war, or slavery could also be contract labor. That is, in the Old Testament, we see you serve X number of years to pay off a debt or earn a commission. Slavery was also a form of apprenticeship, too. That is, you made yourself a slave to a master in a particular craft. In Rome, Ezra would be considered a slave, going off to his slavery to serve an apprenticeship as a cabinet maker. In Rome, so-called slaves often rose to great prominence and wealth and status. Marcus Tullius Tiro, for example, secretary to the great Roman senator Cicero. We'll hear more about Cicero momentarily, too. Hermas, the author of the non-canonical letter of Hermas, was a slave. And finally, Aesop. Those of you that read Aesop's fables to your kids, he was a slave as well, but a very educated and wealthy slave by the time of his death. So, to my mind, not only does MacArthur carefully treat the text, but he also embodies all of the shallow, non-historical thinking on the text, too. So, if you want to see, nevertheless, perhaps the most eloquent apology for the classic Anabaptist position, that is that resistance is never biblical, it's always sinful, check out his John MacArthur's YouTube sermon on Romans 13:1, because it is a challenge to meet his arguments. But they have been met, I submit to you. So then, when is it legitimate, if ever, to resist those who are in authority over us? We covered part one last week. We'll cover part two, hopefully part three. Maybe by Christmas we'll be done. No, maybe in an hour we'll be done. Do you remember the context, first of all, in which God appoints government? Do you remember this from last week? The context in which God appoints government. This text is often abstracted from its context, pasted on the wall, and said, there it is, right? Well, Paul composes our text to remind his readers that they are not to take vengeance upon enemies, but leave it to the wrath of God. Let's look back for a moment here at chapter 12. At about verse 19, he says, beloved, never avenge yourselves. Who is the avenger in our text, right? It is the magistrate who avenges. He is the avenger. Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God. Who is it that executes the wrath of God? It is the magistrate, is it not? For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. To the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink, for by doing so, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. I.e., leave it to the government to execute. This is one of the prime directives of government, isn't it? Not to provide compassion. Compassionate government is an oxymoron. It's up to the church and it's up to the people of that culture to provide compassion, not government. Government is there to execute vengeance, the wrath of God. Paul even goes to the extent of denominating government as the avenger who executes the wrath of God on wrongdoers, using the very same vocabulary to do so. In other words, leave it to the just government magistrates to punish those who do you wrong. We had the opportunity to Skype with our son John this week, who is in Qatar. And I was reminded of the tribal justice that still obtains in the Middle East, places like Afghanistan, where he was stationed a time ago. And John recounted how many of the tribal chieftains merely marked their traditional enemies when we got there, with whom they'd had grievances for generations, just marked them as Al-Qaeda or Taliban, whether they were or not, so that the Americans would go out and destroy them. They're old tribal enemies. Sometimes the tribal chieftains would be given weapons to do it themselves or hire out private security like Blackwater to do the dirty work for them. In effect, personal vengeance and tribal justice rather than true magisterial justice was executed there. Paul says no to all of this. This is our context. Rather, God gives true governmental authority. Those who resist it virtually resist God himself, because he is the one who has instituted government. And to this issue, that is, as to its practice, not merely its institution and establishment, to its practice, the Bible has considerably more to say, considerably more than John MacArthur treats, I submit to you. When you listen to MacArthur's sermon today, you'll all go home and consult it on YouTube. You'll note that he dwells within the narrow confines of Romans 13, very few other texts except for the parallel that we read in 1 Peter chapter 2. And he fails to deal at all with a rich history of interpretation. This was maddening to me. Debbie said, are you all right up there? As I mumbled through my preparation. You okay up there? I love MacArthur, but he fails to deal at all with a rich history of interpretation of not only this text, but all the other texts relating to government in the Bible. Civil government, for example, was first established to administer justice in capital matters. We read in Genesis, and almost all commentators are unanimous on this, that indeed this is where government begins. The Lord said to him, not so. If anyone kills Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold. Vengeance? Where have we heard that before? No private personal vengeance, right? You let established magistrates deal with this instead. Government was also structured by a representative republic in Israel's early life. You may remember Exodus 18, where Jethro comes and consults Moses. He suggests, indeed, that he break down government in representatives of thousands, hundreds, and tens, you recall. Resistance to tyranny, too, is replete all through the Old Testament, from the midwives of Egypt, we saw last week, to Athaliah in our text today. Daniel and his brothers in Babylon, too. Resistance to tyrants. So, as we observed last week, every biblical scholar worth his salt, from the early church fathers, too, we saw this last week, remember Chrysostom, St. Augustine, Thomas Aquinas in the Middle Ages, to the reformers like Luther, Calvin, and Knox, they all wrestled with the entirety of Revelation. This is part of the failing of modern dispensationalists and Anabaptists as they treat a text like this. They fail to consult other texts that have to do with government. Luther, Calvin, Knox, and our founding fathers all wrestled with the entirety of Revelation in order to determine not only the principles of government, like Romans 13, but also questions like Peter declares. We ought to obey God rather than men. Right? And that's easy to say. Even MacArthur, he acknowledges this principle too. At the close of his sermon, he begins to acknowledge, but he conveniently refuses to explain when it kicks into force. When we say it's better to obey God than man. But when does such disobedience obtain? It cries out to be answered. Does it kick in when not only the Pharisees forbid the preaching of Christ, but when Bloody Mary forces a Scot to the Roman Catholic Eucharist? Scots had to deal with this. Knox had to deal with this. Is disobedience warranted when a king steals the long-established family lands and property of his subjects like Ahab robbed Naboth's vineyards? Is rebellion warranted in the case of the nobles of England under King John when they forced him by sharp sword point to sign the Magna Carta? Even as Ezra and Nehemiah forced the returning exiles to treat their brothers with true justice and their property rights, or as Jehoiada did, establishing a covenant. You saw in our text today, establishing a covenant between king and people. Knox took that and said there is an implicit covenant between people and magistrate. And when either one breaks that implicit covenant, punishment is owed. So, unlike MacArthur, our Reformed fathers wrestled with all of these questions, and they came to different conclusions than he does. There are specific narrow circumstances when resistance to tyranny is warranted. Our founding fathers all thought that the phrase resistance to tyrants is obedience to God was a biblical injunction. So it's important to note these conditions under which such resistance is biblically sanctioned. From our point two today, number one, when justice is perverted to injustice. When justice is perverted into injustice. Who loves righteousness or justice like our God? Practically every page of the Old Testament and the New Testament is suffused. Squeeze your Bible and it oozes justice and righteousness, doesn't it? God demands, God requires justice and righteousness. He loves righteousness and justice, the psalmist says. The earth is full of the covenant love of Yahweh. We saw in our text today, endow the king with your justice. This is part of biblical government, is it not? Endow the magistrate. Endow the king with your justice, O God, the prayer was. O God, the royal son, with your righteousness. He will judge your people in righteousness, your afflicted ones with justice. This is a prayer for the inauguration of a king. We'll see that as we treat the Psalms in more detail this coming fall. So when justice is perverted to injustice by the magistrate, what are we to do? He expects the same love of righteousness and justice of those who rule as magistrates in his stead. This is entirely implicit in our text today. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. What happens when that's flipped? Huh? Would you have no fear of the one who is in authority? Paul says, then do what is good, i.e. righteous, just, and you will receive his approval. For he is God's servant. The magistrate is a servant, not an official. In interviewing one of our local officials, as he called himself, I said, well, as a servant of the people, and he rang. Oh, he did not like that. He said, no, I'm an elected official, not a servant. I'm sorry, pal, but the Bible doesn't look at you that way. The magistrate is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he doesn't bear the sword in vain. That has capital punishment lurking behind it, doesn't it? For he is the servant of God, an avenger who carries out God's wrath on the wrongdoer, hearkening back to chapter 12. So, resistance is warranted when indeed justice is perverted to injustice. How can justice prevail? How can righteousness prevail unless the magistrate judges according to true righteousness and justice? Paul is but acting a comedy of errors if there's not an absolute standard of justice to which all men must be measured. How blind the Christian who refuses to see that from the beginning man has this law before his eyes. Once again, Romans is an extended argument for justification by faith, is it not? Back in chapter 2, he says, for when Gentiles who do not have the law of Moses, when they by nature do what the law requires, they're a law to themselves, even though they do not have the law. They show that the work of the law is written on their hearts, while their conscience also bears witness. He's talking about conscience here too, is he not? Conscience of the law, conscience of righteousness, that God has indeed invested in our hearts. While their conscience also bears witness, and their conflicting thoughts accuse or even excuse them. This is how the conscience works, how our conscience must work as well. On that day when, according to my gospel, God judges the secrets of men by Christ Jesus, God will indeed judge our performance in righteousness and justice, and judge governments, judge how we respond to them. That's why we must be very cautious when we consider resistance. When has God ever expected one standard of justice from a Gentile and another from the Jew? Our founding fathers drew upon this rich tradition of what has come to be known as natural law, based in part upon this text from Romans chapter 2. And in that tradition of natural law, all men have a sense of justice and righteousness by which they behave, though it's never enough, of course, to reveal God saving them. For that, we need special revelation. The Roman jurist Cicero is one example of such a man. I quote from his work. He says, true law is right reason in agreement with nature and God, the supreme being. It is of universal application, unchanging and everlasting. It summons to duty by its commands and averts from wrongdoing by its prohibitions. It is a sin to try to alter this law, nor is it allowable to repeal any part of it. Unquote, Cicero. In fact, Rome, in its formative period during the Republic, shaped its sense of justice based precisely upon this principle of natural law. Right reason in agreement with nature and its God, the supreme being, as Cicero puts it. Jefferson says about Cicero, they studied not only the reformers and texts like this and the early church fathers, but they also studied men like Cicero. Jefferson says of Cicero, Cicero is indeed the father of eloquence and philosophy. He had a keen understanding of natural law. And so we see its principles in noble men like the Roman tribune Claudius Lysias in Acts. Do you remember? Despite Nero being emperor, he hasn't gone off his lid just yet, and we'll touch on that as we close the book of Acts, just who this man Nero was. But there was still that remnant, that residue of true Roman justice that was extant yet in the kingdom. We see it exercised in Claudius Lysias. Natural law dictated that all citizens had the right of appeal to the highest authority, that is, Paul's appeal to Caesar. That's another example of objective Roman justice. And so it should be obeyed, right? We should be submissive. Paul is submissive, indeed, to every Roman authority along the line. And they, in turn, practice Roman justice. Remember, Rome endured for over 1,000 years. Though pagan, founded in blood, read the myth of Romulus and Remus, Rome nevertheless developed principles of natural law to which Paul could appeal here and now in our text. Rulers are not a terror to good conduct, he says, but to bad. He, that is the Roman magistrate, is God's servant for your good. Now, although those principles of natural law would erode, become corrupted as the empire sank into collapse, accelerated by the Antichrist, Nero, America, take note, Paul could nevertheless appeal to its principles for Christians to live by and Rome's magistrates to apply justice and righteousness. There's great irony in the fact that the empire that would become the beast of Revelation, a prototype of the enduring beast we see today, the satanic enemy of the church, but who nevertheless could not function without founding its principles in God's law, natural law, an apology for presuppositional apologetics, I submit to you. The lost man must borrow from biblical principles to even reason rightly, right? So, understand that it is to this sense of the good to which Paul appeals. Secondly, when is it biblical? When is it right? When is it our duty to resist? Secondly, when the conscience of the Christian, when the conscience of the Christian can no longer be compelled to obey. Remember, it's one thing to submit to government, especially in principle. It's another to obey every last jot, tittle, and command. And MacArthur conveniently ignores stipulating when this is the case, although he acknowledges it in principle, that Christian can no longer be compelled to obey when his conscience is at stake. But, Dr. MacArthur, this is precisely what the church and our founding fathers labored so mightily to do over the intervening millennia between then and when you preached your sermon, and which you and others like you scold them for doing, but which you refuse to do yourself. It is hypocrisy to chide one brother for applying his conscience to his circumstances when you refuse to do it in your generation, I submit to you. Take the time to read St. Augustine's City of God, for example, and you will understand the church's appeal to Rome's better nature in natural law. Augustine does that on almost every page. Take the time to read Luther and Calvin, and you will understand their struggle, too, to apply their own consciences to their own day. Calvin lived almost his entire days in Geneva under the threat of invasion by the Roman Catholic cantons in Switzerland. They applied their own consciences to their own day, the lines, the limits, the lives of disobedience and resistance they must live. Can a man suspend his conscience when it comes to government? Is he supposed to do that? Is he to be punctilious, scrupulous in his personal walk as he's expected to be? Paul exhorts us to do this constantly, right? Conforming his life to Christ, but shut it off when it comes to the magistrate? Are we to preach Christ to everyone and everything? Mark says, go into all the world, proclaim the gospel to the whole creation. To the whole creation. And not expect that gospel to transform government, society, and culture too? Preach Christ, yes. Preach Christ, nothing but Christ. Always Christ. But you don't expect it to transform government, culture, and society? What kind of half-Christian are you? That gospel is powerful enough to do so. So, implicit here is the transformed conscience. Therefore, Paul says, one must be in subjection not only to avoid God's wrath, i.e., the sword of the magistrate, but also for the sake of conscience. Our forebearers wrestled with this. For decades, centuries after Paul composed this text, the Christians found themselves with that sword at their throats, didn't they? Suddenly, under Constantine, they found that sword in their hands. What do you do with your conscience now that the sword is in your hand? Our forebearers wrestled with that question because that is a real question too that MacArthur ignores. Our conscience, this is our operating principle. When the magistrate is administering government according to principles of good versus evil, as Paul assumes here, do so. Be in subjection, indeed. But what happens when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism? I'm having a flashback here. How about you? It is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. Who said that? They wrestled with these things themselves, and not lightly. Such was the conscience of our founders. They were not operating in a vacuum. But unlike MacArthur, they had done their homework. They read not only their Bibles, but they read Cicero and Luther and Calvin, men like John Knox as well. Greaves, Richard Greaves, in his book, The Theology, let me see here, what does it get the title right? Theology and Revolution in the Scottish Reformation. He says, Knox propounded the idea of a covenant between king and people, which was equally binding on both parties. And he resourced text like we resourced today from 2 Kings chapter 11, that there is indeed a covenant, implicit covenant between people and magistrate. Articulating a doctrine, Greaves goes on to say, articulating a doctrine of tyrannicide on the grounds that tyranny abused the power granted to man by God. Knox cited biblical and classical precedents, which I've been underlining for you all these last 2 weeks. The unjust ruler who violates the laws and customs of his land no longer can claim the obedience of his subjects. He may justly resist him and, if necessary, depose and execute him. John Knox. He also formed the template for the Scottish Reformation, the Scots. No timid people, are they? No timid effort on their part either. Knox was fond of saying of the Scots, a wild goose never laid tame eggs. Neither did the Scots, for they were not a tame people. The Declaration of Arbroath in AD 1320 says, for so long as 100 men remain alive, we shall never under any conditions submit to the domination of the English. It is not for glory or riches or honors that we fight, but only for liberty, which no good man will consent to lose but with his life. The Scots. How we Presbyterians love the Scots, don't we? We love the Scots. In part because at the Westminster Assembly, they carried weight and influence far beyond their numbers. Our confession and catechisms are what they are precisely because the Reformation was brought to bear in great clarity, force, and purity in Scotland. Why is that? Let me ask you, why is that? Because they resisted on biblical grounds. Due in part not only to the character and strength of the Scots, but in part exactly because the Scots kicked butt and took names, didn't they? They resisted tyranny. They fought the British. They sang psalms while they went into battle. I know a few psalm-only Presbyterians. Well, they love to recall this. Favorite anecdotes. Some of those same men would no more fight for their liberty than Dr. MacArthur, however. Do you find this ironic? I do. How passingly strange. What would he be without the Scots and their biblical principled resistance, led by the firebrand John Knox? One of my favorite battles, it's a great book, Famous Scottish Battles. I'll loan it to you if you want when I'm done. One of my favorite battles was the Battle of Newburn, August 1640. They routed the British in part because they put a cannon on the roof of the church. The Scots reasoned that if indeed the word of God, when it was preached in that church, could go to the dividing of heart and spirit, well, then a cannon on the church roof would do the same to the hard-headed skulls of those crypto-Catholics. The Battle of Newburn. The Scots were known, of course, for being wild Celts in their roots. But after the Battle of Newburn, the historian says, perhaps the most notable aspect of these captures, and they not only captured Newburn, but captured cities surrounding Newburn, he says, perhaps the most notable aspect of these captures was the fact that the Scots behaved with utmost propriety. Women were safe in their hands. The silver in your cabinets was safe in their hands. Just don't preach an Arminian sermon or have it found out that you're a papist. Then it was Katie by the door. It said, the Scots behaved with the utmost propriety, plundering nothing, paying for everything except artillery and arms. Truly, times had changed. These were not the blue-faced Celts that they were used to dealing with, but converted Christians now. Our founders drew upon the Scottish Reformation as well for strength, for insight, for principled resistance. They thought through this. It wasn't a careless, oh, we're espousing Enlightenment principles here and that's it. No. They resourced, they looked to the Reformation for strength and for the ideas and notions of principled resistance. Just read the Declaration of Independence. We cited it last week, didn't we? On numerous occasions. And some of the Bill of Rights, founded precisely on a just war theory. We also talked about that a little bit last week. So they did their homework, unlike Dr. MacArthur. Love them, though I do. Brothers and sisters, I will be held accountable for this sermon. I will be held accountable for what I am encouraging you to think through and to establish as principle in your own life for action, not only in my case, but your case as well. I thought about that. I have prayed about that for years, especially over the last few weeks in preparing this short series. We will be held accountable. So will Dr. MacArthur be held accountable for what he has inculcated and what he has encouraged his people to do as well. So I will leave then that to Judgment Day, when indeed I will be held accountable for this. But I'm convinced to my toenails, in my bones, that I'm right. Let us now then come to that place where we find genuine liberty in the Lord of the table as well, who has won a great victory for us, has he not? We find true liberty in the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.